The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Two isolated groups of surviving Russians attempt to join forces to overcome John Rourke and his German allies in a race to gain access to a nuclear arsenal in China.
If whoever has taken over the leadership of Karamazov's army should find the remainder of the Chinese nuclear arsenal or effect some sort of treaty with the Soviet forces based in the Pacific and thereby obtain nuclear weapons, it is unthinkable.
The unthinkable became reality 5 centuries before. It doesn't mean undoable anymore, Captain.
Natalia and the Rourke family face assassination squads in China and an attack on their stronghold in Georgia.
There is no need for your men to die. They can walk out of here alive and unmolested. If you order them to withdraw before they take the lives of my family, you can join them or stay and fight me. Whatever you wish.
We all came, Dr. Rourke, knowing we would never leave.
What the hell are they doing?
Assaulting the retreat, it appears.
Why? And who are they?
They must be planning to plant explosive charges where they think the main entrance is.
Could conventional explosives do anything?
No location is completely insusceptible to explosive damage if the job is done correctly.
Weil! Etwas ist hier falsch!
You're German, Paul.
German? But...
we'll discuss it later.
Horst! Get down!
Eden Base members Halverson and Kuranami must find safe harbor with Wolfgang Mann's forces or face murder charges from Commander Dodd.
Colonel Mann, how dare you hold this man and his female accomplice in total defiance of my request? Kuranami is subject to the military discipline of Eden Base Command. He is mine, and so is his accomplice, Dr. Halverson.
It would appear that none of the Eden personnel are unaccounted for, yet you insist that the lieutenant has murdered someone. Who might these dead be? German nationals who are enemies of the state? Criminals with whom you, perhaps, sympathize?
I don't have to take your insults, Colonel.
Nor do I have to return Lieutenant Kuranami and his fiancée, the Fräulein Doctor.
Where the rocks narrow up ahead, it's a good spot for an ambush. The tires! Get out of there! We're clear! Get out of there!
John!
The tires!
John!
Natalia! Natalia! Damn it!
John!
Hold on, sweetheart.
A haunting past, a harrowing future, and betrayal from within all challenge John Rourke's skills in Survivalist No. 16, The Arsenal, in Graphic Audio.
Smoke Jensen is a man with blood on his hands.
Do you have any idea of the numbers of graves I've got on my back trail? Enough to populate a fair-sized town, and then some.
He finds himself coming to a crossroads. The price he must pay for all that killing is something that Smoke will no longer bear.
I'm tired of all the blood. I'm tired of all the killing. I'm tired of the looks people give me. I'm tired of being the most notorious gun in all the so-called Wild West. I hope I never have to pull a gun in anger again.
But that was before Smoke ever knew the name of Frederick von Hausen.
Jensen! Smoke Jensen! Your time has come to die! Not by a faster gun, but by a man who is much more intelligent than you! You'll see, Jensen. You'll see.
When the pompous German aristocrat looking for the ultimate thrill kill comes beating down Smoke Jensen's door, Smoke will be pushed to the very limits of his endurance.
No man will talk down to me and expect to live. I'll stand and fight. And when I decide to do that, I won't be taking any prisoners for trial.
When there are no other options, sometimes violence is the only way.
You're all gonna die.
Don't miss a second of the brutally violent action in Smoke Jensen No. 9, Pursuit of the Mountain Man. Rivers of blood will flow.
Now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
In the depths of the forest, the expedition froze at the sound, in startled anticipation of violence. But then saw the parrot fly from its perch in the branches of a tree overhead. Austin Fargo's hand dropped to the massive revolver on his hip. His other tightened around the handle of the machete, frozen in mid-stroke, at a green branch barring his progress. Had this been sooner on their journey, Fargo would have relaxed his tightly wound nerves with a laugh. But the hard rubber checkering on his handgun dug into the pads of his fingers, and his throat was tight. 2 days earlier, when the expedition set out, Fargo was looking for a gold mine of technology, the materials that the Millennial Consortium would need to wrest control from such adversaries as the rebels of Cerberus Redoubt or the Tigers of Heaven. Stockpiles of weapons in the Kashmir region would give the consortium an edge in creating their new empire, which was why Austin Fargo had 20 trained soldiers and twice that many technicians on hand. The 100 bearers packing their supplies were paralyzed with worry, and only Fargo's display of stern discipline kept the lot of them from deserting the human train as it crawled through the uncharted forest. It was one thing to be cut in two by the snarl of a Coleco machine pistol, and even the slash of a machete brought a quick demise. The coiled loops of leather that hung on Fargo's hip, on the other hand, peeled flesh from the body in inch-wide strips, one lash at a time. The Indian deserter whom Fargo had singled out was a giant, 6.5 feet, with a barrel chest and long arms and legs as solid as tree limbs. Fargo had taken his time, peeling the big Indian's skin off with the crack of tightly woven leather. After what felt like an hour, Fargo's arm had started to grow tired. The Indian hung by his wrists, bared ribs and shoulder blades gleaming where the whip had flayed skin and muscle away. The deserter had been reduced to a gibbering mass, a once powerful man stripped of his strength by the cruelty of Fargo's whip. Finally, Fargo had wound the whip back up, hanging it on the metal hook on his belt. Somewhere in those last few minutes of lashing leather, blood loss or shock had stilled the big man's heart. Thoughts of rebellion were crushed. Fargo would make them pay, and the display of violence was foremost in the thoughts of the Indians laden with the expedition's supplies. That should have been enough to keep everyone well behaved. But then the ghost sightings began. Fargo hated to call the stalkers ghosts, but the only other whispered explanation came from the primitives who had borne the supplies on this arduous trek. They called the shadows Naga, legendary snake creatures that lived beneath the surface of the world, interacting with men only when they chose. Fargo was well acquainted with the idea of reptilian humans, from his adventures in England to interactions with the Anunnaki overlords and their scaled Nephilim slaves. The snake men, with their hinged and poisonous fangs, were feared by the natives of post-Skydark India. The Kashmir region had for centuries been a contested territory, warred over by the nations of India and Pakistan for strategic purposes and for the vast agricultural benefits it had provided. On the other side of the forest, the remnants of Pakistan's survivors held their ground. Likewise, the Indians stayed on their side of the edge of the forest. No one even went to the tree line to harvest logs to create more housing in the snarled shantytown. The idea of leaving such resources untouched nagged at Fargo. A shadowy figure, man-like in size and shape, stepped onto the trail ahead of him. At first, the millennialist thought it was a figment of his overactive imagination. His fingers wrapped around the black rubber grips of his .45 caliber revolver as he realized it was more than just a phantom. Gleaming yellow eyes, partially obscured by a silhouetted hood, flashed as the figure's nod acknowledged Fargo's attention.
Have you not listened to the men you have enslaved? Why do you come here?
I come to you representing the Millennial Consortium. I'm here to make contact with the keepers of a trove reported in this area. We are a peaceful group seeking to negotiate a deal with you.
You're well armed for a mission of peace.
I'd be a fool to come unarmed into a nation filled with tribal feuds and bandits. And in the south, there are violent cultists.
They call themselves the Nagas. They believe themselves to be like unto us.
The shadowed, amber-eyed stranger was not alone. Odds were that the expedition was surrounded. Fargo glanced back to the Coleco-toting millennialist enforcers and nodded.
This can either be peaceful or painful. Your choice, stranger.
Please. We seem to have gotten off on the wrong foot.
The tall figure stepped into a shaft of sunlight, piercing down from the forest canopy.
My name is Durga, Prince of the True Blooded Naga.
Fargo watched Durga flip back the hood of his long, formless black cloak. Durga's head and slender neck were blended into a flat, powerful sheet of muscle that instantly solidified the truth of the legendary Cobra Man of India. Save for the folds of his cloak that clung to broad, powerful shoulders, Durga was naked to the waist, his chest laden with large, segmented plates in a paler hue than the scales that adorned his arms, face, and ribs. The belly armor was the color of age-stained bone, while the smaller, finer scales glimmered metallic blue and green, shimmering almost like silk. The Cobra Man's yellow eyes remained locked on Fargo, and his thin, scaled lips were turned up at the corners in bemusement.
Brothers, step out and introduce yourselves. Slowly and politely.
Perhaps as many as 30 similarly cloaked figures strode from the shadows of the trees. Like their self-proclaimed true-blooded prince, they were lean, slender figures. All were hairless, though not all of them had the perfect sheens of snake-like armor that their leader sported. On the Naga men who weren't completely reptilian, bared patches of human flesh seemed like swollen, discolored rashes rather than normal sunburned flesh. Scales twinkled like dew-wet grass amid the untransformed flesh. Fargo thought back to the semi-reptilian guardsmen in England, men genetically augmented to be more than human. The transformed Englishman looked pathetic in comparison to the powerful, graceful, cobra-hooded Naga.
Make your weapons friendly, lads. Muzzles down, but triggers hot. Just a precaution, you understand.
It is understandable. We are strangers indeed. We are obscenely alien to your mammal eyes.
Not completely. I've met others who have transformed themselves, but not as well as you have.
Ah, yes. The Englanders. Strongbow had sent scouts to seek a refinement of his crude process. We greeted them as brothers, but sadly our lost relatives once more were lost. But it is no wonder that our appearance does not panic you.
Fargo glanced back to his millennialist allies.
No, not completely.
Such a shame.
Where the rest of Fargo's party displayed confusion, the millennialist explorer's muscles tensed in anticipation of hell unleashed. Durga took one step forward. And Fargo sidestepped, barely avoiding the slashing rake of unhinging fangs in the Naga's mouth. A spray of fluid then issued from Durga's venom sacs as they squeezed themselves out, disgorging their deadly payloads. Fargo took another step back, holding his whip. The blow would have lacerated any normal man down to the gleaming bloody white bone beneath. It was a fast-draw slash that had split faces open from forehead to chin in the past. Instead, one yellow eye was clamped shut.
Fire!
A dozen millennialists held their faces as venom seared into their tear ducts and mucous membranes, burning like acid. Fargo whirled and bolted into the foliage, realizing that the poison-blinded guards and bearers had been neutralized. Out of his peripheral vision, he could see the sinewy Naga lunging at blinded, agonized humans. Curved knives and distended jaws slashed into pink and brown flesh alike.
Him! Get that miserable ape and drag him before me!
Fargo tried to escape the fight, charging toward the frontier. But the cobra-hooded warriors were in hot pursuit of the fleeing archaeologist. Vaulting over roots, rocks, and ruts with the ease of a man who'd run for his life across six continents, Fargo avoided tripping and stumbling. For a moment, the archaeologist was elated that despite their venom and tough scales, they were as fallible and clumsy as any human. Fargo changed course and allowed gravity to drag him down a muddy hillside. He rocketed to the bottom of the slope and sprang into a dead run through a copse of trees. Fargo kept up his frantic pace. He remembered his mental map, visualizing a steep cliff bordering a turgid river. It had forced the expedition to change its course by 5 miles, slowing the trek to a tedious crawl. He remembered that the height of the drop-off was around 40 feet. While he would consider himself likely to catch an instantly fatal bullet, the ideal outcome was a splash in the river, its powerful current carrying him south and away from the serpentine assassins on his tail. On foot, the Naga warriors would not be able to keep up and shoot at Fargo at the same time. The trees thinned out, and the ground began to slope. Fargo's mud-caked boots turned into wet slicks, forcing him into an arm-windmilling effort at balance as gravity whipped him into a wild slide. The skid downhill came to a sudden end as Fargo rocketed out into the air over the rolling waters beneath. There was an odd, queasy moment of weightlessness as Fargo sailed to the waters. Just before he knifed into the river, he caught sight of a helicopter coming over the tree line. Momentum pushed him nearly to the bottom as the water exerted its breaking force on him. The current shoved hard, toppling him into a spin that he kicked out of, arms and legs dragging him toward the silty bottom. With a twist, he looked up through the surface of the river, seeing the warped image of the sky and the ledge hanging over him. Fargo knew that he had barely a minute before his lungs forced him to surface, but cold dread of that helicopter stilled his urge to swim upward. The helicopter's black shape poked out from the overhang of the ledge. Its flattened fish profile blotted out the sun, while rotor wash created a flat dish in the water, creating a lens that the Naga could see through. Fargo had no trouble seeing the huge bulk as it hovered, and given the clarity of the river, he was easily visible to the airborne pursuers. A Cobra man leaned out of the door with his automatic rifle. One bullet plucked at his forearm. The current dragged him along, a cloud of dark blood smearing behind him in a corkscrew. Had it not been for the refraction of the crystal clear water, the Naga sniper would have riddled Fargo's chest. The explorer kept his cool, playing dead. His lungs burned as the enemy helicopter ascended and joined two more aircraft. Together, they hung in the sky for a moment before they broke north, back past the forbidden frontier that Fargo had dared to penetrate. In three long strokes, he broke the surface. He dragged himself to shore and crawled between two dense bushes to shield himself from discovery in case the humanoid snake warrior saw fit to return. With his good hand and his teeth, he fashioned a compress and bandage for his gunshot wound. The Millennial Consortium wouldn't be pleased at the loss of the expedition, especially now that it had been proved that there were operating aircraft in the stockpiles possessed by the Naga. When the Millennialists were disappointed, they tended to shoot the messenger. Already, though, the redoubt raider had a plan to minimize the blame and to appease the consortium. For the plan to work, Fargo had to get to the Bitterroot Mountains. The Outlanders Kane, Grant, and Bridget Baptiste could succeed where a consortium expeditionary force had failed. If they didn't, they would still inflict horrendous losses upon the Snake Men, giving a new Millennial Strike team sufficient advantage to finish the job. Should Kane and company prevail, then a force meant to crush an army of serpent warriors would be more than enough to deal with the Cerberus interlopers. It was the kind of win-win scenario that would allow the survivor Fargo a chance to retain his position and support within the consortium. The journey of 1,000 miles, however, needed to start with one step. Using a low branch for support, Fargo hauled himself achingly to his feet. With each stride, the explorer put distance between himself and the forbidden frontier. It was a temporary separation, though. Austin Fargo would return, bringing vengeance to the snakes who had struck at him. Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Outlanders. Narrated by Terence Aselford. With performances by Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, David Coyne, Dolores King-Williams, Colleen Delaney, Eric Messner, Nathan Bennett, James Konacek, Elizabeth Demery, Andy Clements, Ken Jackson, Tim Carlin, Yasmin Tuazon, Tony Nam, Tom Simpson, and Mort Shelby. Outlanders number 48, Serpent's Tooth. The return to Cobaltville was meant to be a mission of mercy, but as Kane crouched in the shadows, watching the Coldhearts holding Bridget Baptiste and Grant at gunpoint, he was reminded that strength and mercy were two qualities that had to go hand in hand.
Come on out! All we want are the meds, not trouble from you!
As Kane wrenched his fighting knife from the ribs of the raider who'd tried to ambush him, he studied the scene behind the clinic. He would need information about these cold hearts, which meant that he would have to carefully get in touch with his companions over the built-in Comtact communicator implanted behind his ear and attached to the mastoid bone.
Grant, what happened?
From his vantage point, Kane could see the massive Grant, clad in a tank top and cargo pants, clasping his hands behind his bald, mahogany-colored head as he was surrounded by raiders. Thick, powerful arms glistened like dark bronze in the sun. The big ex-magistrate was careful not to move his lips.
Fuckers popped out of the woodwork while I was moving crates. With my hands full, they swarmed us.
My fault.
Kane's glance shot to the striking former archivist. Where he had a pang of concern for Grant, his fellow magistrate for years, and the closest thing to a brother that the lone warrior had, the sight of the flame-haired woman held at gunpoint was worth a full wince.
I should have waited for you.
That's neither here nor there.
Well, we're here, and you're there.
Kane scanned the scene from his vantage point. Four bandits now surrounded Grant. It was always a risky proposition to bring medical supplies into the shantytown known as the Tartarus Pits, a sprawl that had grown in the shadow of the tower that housed the higher-ranking subjects of the hybrid barons. The medicine used by the healers at the Cobaltville Clinic was almost as valuable as a cache of firearms in the lawless outlands. Kane, Bridget, and Grant were making the delivery, utilizing wheelbarrows to ferry the supplies to the healers who worked in the area. Colin Phillips, the leader of the ragtag group of physicians and their assistants, had warned Kane and the others about the presence of the band of raiders. They were led by Lombard, a man familiar to Kane. The head bandit was a former magistrate who operated almost exclusively in the Tartarus pits. The allure of easy money and quick satisfaction had corrupted Lombard, something the other magistrates had done their best to ignore. Lombard disappeared after killing a fellow mag, knowing his life was now worthless if he encountered any of the grim group that he'd betrayed. With the barons now long gone from Cobaltville, most of the magistrates had also moved on, working as sec men for caravans or small settlements, while the more corrupt went into business for themselves. Lombard saw Cobaltville as easy pickings. Not that the ex-mag was alone. Lombard had assembled easily a dozen men, according to Kane's observations. The bandit leader glared toward Grant and Bridget.
Ugh.
Lombard reached for the flame-haired archivist's chin, giving it a squeeze.
Communicators?
Bridget grabbed his wrist and pried the grubby, grasping paw away from her face. Around them, Phillips and his fellow healers remained still. They knew the drill, having endured previous raids, but Kane could see the frustration in their faces. The cold-blooded marauders had taken Bridget's and Grant's weapons at gunpoint, enticed by the new meat before them.
So, where's your friend?
Lombard's thumb glided over the silvery plate of the contact implant behind Bridget's ear.
It's a radio, not a radar unit, dimwit. Besides, do you think that a magistrate like Kane would give away his position?
The predatory marauders were bold when it came to unarmed victims, but the presence of a magistrate, especially the legendary Kane, would make the formerly cocky thugs pause. Kane flexed his forearm muscles, and the Sin Eater slapped into his hand. The full-auto Sin Eater would be necessary in the eventuality of a furious firefight, but Kane held his fire. The Cerberus warriors didn't want stray bullets to harm any of the healers whose only crime was endangering themselves for the sake of the huddled masses and the remnants of Cobaltville. Besides, Kane had learned long ago that mind games and intimidation could reduce the need for violence or control the reactions of his quarry.
Fucking mags? Kane, no less!
Lombard glared at the massive Grant, a towering figure in his own right. The olive-green tank top left little doubt about the awesome power contained in his muscular arms and shoulders. It had been years since Lombard had last seen Grant. To assist with his disguise as just another guy the size of a colossal statue, Grant was wearing a pair of wire-rimmed glasses and had traded his forearm-holstered Sin Eater for a belt-holstered Heckler & Koch MP5K. In a nearby wheelbarrow, he had hidden both his Sin Eater and a compact copperhead assault rifle, ready to be reached through a pre-cut opening.
Then who the fuck are you?
I'm just a delivery boy. Does she look like she can haul around crates full of this shit?
Lombard glanced over to the slender but fit young woman. Bridget didn't look like a delicate flower, thanks to years of adventuring across the globe. Though it was obvious that she was in very good shape, Kane knew that there was a mentality among his fellow magistrates to dismiss women as incapable because of their softer bodies. Bridget shrunk from the renegade magistrate. Lombard then looked over to his crew.
Still, it's only one mag bastard.
Well, I guess if you're the standard they measure mags by these days.
Reuben, if this over-muscled dickhead talks again, shoot him with his own gun.
Grant looked down at the bandit Lombard had spoken to. Reuben, a young, tattooed punk wearing a leather vest, was a foot shorter than Grant. He gripped the machine pistol with whitened knuckles.
Don't shoot yourself with that thing, Reuben.
I'm not simple, you damn freak.
Could have fooled me. You keep pointing that muzzle at your friends and your fingers locked on that trigger. If it weren't for the fact that you haven't deactivated the safety on the gun, you'd have shot your partners 20 times over.
Reuben glanced down at the machine pistol, looking for the safety. Having relieved his would-be ambusher of his walkie-talkie and twin single-action revolvers, Kane dropped the dead man into a ditch. The radio would give Kane even more intelligence against the bandits. The handguns were typical of what the robbers had, a blend of pump shotguns, bolt-action rifles, and old revolvers, which explained Reuben's confusion over Grant's more complicated HK. In the 2 centuries since Skydark, technology was no longer uniformly equal, and maintenance-intensive devices such as automatic weapons were now nearly as common here as manually cycled firearms and tough old solid-state circuitry, which could be reconstructed from simple wire. The bandit radio was one such cobbled-together piece of technology, presumably a simple circuit board, some magnets, and wire wrapped in a hard little case. Kane figured that if he ran out of ammunition, he could use the boxy walkie-talkie to smash open an enemy gunman's skull and not even cause harm to the electronics within. He aimed the dead man's revolver toward the sky.
Banyan! Banyan! Report!
Lombard looked back toward his crew.
Second team on Banyan's position, now!
Good luck catching Kane.
Reuben, I thought I told you to shoot that loudmouth!
I can't get the gun working!
You really think that shooting me is going to affect a hard bastard like Kane?
You're annoying me, shithead. I've heard of Kane, and he's nothing special.
No, he's only the most dangerous man ever to patrol the Tartarus pits. Who else would I hire to protect us?
Listen, bitch. Kane might have been hot shit in the old days, but I know all of his stupid tricks.
Lombard, we found a puddle of blood.
What about Banyan?
Nothing. But we found another wheelbarrow full of supplies. No sign of any mags, though.
Son of a bitch! Leave the meds for now. Find that fucking mag before he turns everything to shit!
Where'd your bravado go, Lombard?
Show yourself, Kane, or we start killing your people, and we'll make it slow.
Go ahead. I already have the first half of my pay. I'm sure I can find a good buyer for the Dread Bandit Lombard's severed head, too.
Lombard dropped his radio as if it were a venomous snake, dancing back in fright. Sandwiched between 2 makeshift huts, Kane observed the search party that had stumbled upon the crimson slick that was the last evidence of Banyan's existence. 6 marauders milled around, their eyes wide and fearful. Counting the 5 hanging around Lombard, watching Bridget, Grant, and the doctors, that made a full dozen cold hearts, with a few more most likely still hanging back on perimeter security.
Pick up your damned comm, you coward.
Kane's threat attracted the attention of one of the brighter members of the Marauders' hunting party. The shotgun-toting thug stalked cautiously along the alley between rows of huts, looking for a clear view of Lombard. If it hadn't been for Kane's well-honed senses, the stealthy thief would have been unheard. Instead, Kane locked onto the approaching gunman.
Okay, Kane.
With the bandit almost upon him, Kane reversed the revolver in his grasp and whipped the handle violently toward the bridge of the curious bandit's nose. Swiftly, Kane snatched the still-standing corpse and hauled it between the 2 huts, jamming it down into the clutter on the walkway floor.
You want the medicine, then you don't need to bully those sheep you're holding. Walk away, and I won't have to waste any ammunition killing you fused-out pricks.
Lombard glanced at Grant, who let his powerful shoulders sag in a display of false helplessness. Bridget also put on the airs of cornered, helpless prey. It was a good act, and if Kane hadn't witnessed their efficacy against countless enemies, he would have been convinced. The 2 companions were figuring out the angles necessary to take down the bandits with maximum efficiency and the least harm to the Cobaltville healers.
Where's Russ?
Lombard turned his attention toward the source of the shout. In that quick glance, the Marauder leader glimpsed the silhouette of the wolf-lean Kane.
There! There he is!
The five raiders around Lombard spun in unison, ignoring their hostages as they raised their guns to burn down Kane. Grant exploded into action first, his long, brawny right arm circling Reuben's throat. With a hard yank, the bandit's feet were dragged into the air, whipping toward the head of a second Cold Heart. Surprised, Reuben watched his partner drop to the ground after the wrenching impact of booted feet on his skull. Grant's left hand clawed the MP5K loose from stunned fingers. He aimed as a third gunman swung his bolt-action rifle at the spot where Kane's silhouette had been. Bridget was only a half heartbeat slower than Grant. She pulled a box cutter from a nearby table and thumbed the razor edge out of its blunt sheath nose. It was a quick, practiced movement as she whipped it in a savage backhand across the face of a fourth hostage taker. Skin and muscle flapped down from the gunman's cheekbone, highlighting the razor's sharp passage to the bisected eye. In shock, he dropped his weapons to free his hands for the task of holding his face together. Bridget scooped up the half-blinded man's pistol in a lightning-fast movement. Lombard and the remaining bandit were torn between the options of shooting Grant, Kane, or Bridget. Grant rendered the dilemma moot, aiming the machine pistol at Lombard's shotgunner. Lombard took a fourth option and charged down an alley. Bridget swung her pistol toward the rogue mag. But the bullet was just a second too slow to catch the fleeing coward. Kane stepped into view of his pursuers, both revolvers held at eye level. The buffoon, who'd cried out for the clever but dead Russ, was dead on the ground, blood pooling around the body. The brutal death of their comrade stunned the remaining four gunmen. That bought Kane time. The marauder with a split face folded over in agony, a bullet now burning in his bowels. A second gunman whirled with a shattered shoulder joint, collapsing as he clutched his ruined limb. Kane sidestepped, taking cover behind the corner of a hut, but the remaining two bandits were in no mood to fight back. They were fleeing for their lives. Just to make certain, Kane aimed at their heels. The rebuffed predators only picked up speed, not even weaving to avoid being shot in the back. Terror, not tactics, ruled the minds of the pair. Any thoughts of returning fire had been abandoned with the elimination of their friends. The man with the bullet in his belly lay in a growing pool of bright arterial blood. It had been only a few seconds since the initial hit, meaning that Kane had severed the bandit's aorta. The other raider, his shoulder reduced to stringy, bloody pulp, fumbled with his rifle, flipping it across the alley toward Kane.
I give up! Don't shoot! I'm unarmed!
You think I'm blind? Pull the pistol from your belt!
The raider looked down at the handle poking from under the folds of his shirt. His left hand clumsily dislodged it while avoiding any semblance of grasping it firmly.
How large was Lombard's gang?
There was 20 of us.
Kane nodded, doing the math, then activated the contact.
Baptiste, Grant, we've got about 10 more raiders out there.
We got two prisoners here that confirm those numbers.
No medics were harmed, except for the initial roughhousing by the bandits. Do you think Lombard will regroup and try to finish the job, Kane?
Lombard lost half his crew trying to get these meds. I don't know. Black market medicine is worth a hell of a lot, but money won't bring you back from the dead.
Kane escorted his prisoner to the intersection, seeing Bridget tend to Phillips. The medic had a cut on his forehead, and blood stained his white coat pink from the seeping wound. On closer examination, though, Kane was relieved to see that Phillips' eyes were focused.
No concussion, just a mess.
Good luck for me, at least.
Us too. I wouldn't want to lose any allies here in Cobaltville. You're worth more than any five gunslingers we could recruit, Phillips.
Especially for rebuilding Cobaltville.
I appreciate the sentiment, guys. Just wish these bastards hadn't cracked my head open.
Kane began packing the shoulder of his prisoner with a kerchief so he wouldn't need immediate attention. Phillips slowly got up to deal with the bleeding laceration of the man Bridget had carved with the box cutter. Reuben was holding his throat, looking weak and sickly after being swung around as a human weapon. An orderly looked at Phillips, then shook his head.
They attacked us. They injured you. And they're not a threat anymore. Maybe you feel like you can pick and choose when to apply mercy, but that's not the oath I took.
Besides, I don't think the danger's over yet.
At the sight of the stranger in the forest, Domi slipped her satchel full of scrounged books from her shoulder, hiding it in a corner between the raised roots of an ancient tree. The small but cord-muscled albino woman didn't want to lose her latest haul from the library in the event of a chase, or if the stranger had allies who would capture her. Armed with only her dagger and a pistol crossbow for catching game while in the wild, the youngest, most feral member of the Cerberus Redoubt focused her ruby-red eyes intently on the newcomer, sizing him up. The security of Cerberus had been breached many times in the scant years that Domi had called the Redoubt her home. As the commander of Cerberus away team Beta, however, she'd proved to be more than merely a wayward refugee in the ancient facility. She'd battled reptilian invaders with spacecraft and gods armed with technology that could have been mistaken for mythical weaponry, all in the name of protecting her lover, Lakesh, and the ever-growing population of the pre-dark bastion of technology, knowledge, and security. The man wending his way toward the Bitterroot Mountain stronghold had, no doubt, picked this arduous route to avoid Skydog and the Lakota Indians who were staunch allies of Cerberus. Domi had crossed this particular terrain with the nimbleness of a mountain goat, spring steel leg muscles bounding her along the rocky, uneven path with preternatural ease. She noticed that the man was no stranger to hard journeying, but exhaustion weighed on his powerful limbs. Domi regretted leaving behind the contact implant at the redoubt as she observed the lone traveler. She had gotten into the habit of isolating herself on these solitary expeditions to achieve a measure of solace, as Lakesh described it. Such trips were meant to escape the confines of the base, abandoning both people and modern technology. The act of shedding the contact was the ultimate statement of that mental journey. Domi thumbed the safety on her crossbow. The bolt was now ready to be released with only the touch of her finger on the trigger. The broad-headed tip was an aggressive assembly of four veined blades designed to inflict enormous trauma as it pierced the organs of animals as large and as fierce as bears. She wondered at the stranger's affiliation and his motives for approaching the redoubt. From his focus and his direction, there was no way that he could miss the base. Nothing else was nearby for hundreds of miles. The man was armed with a large revolver stuffed into a leather scabbard that rode on his thigh. A coiled bullwhip hung from a hook on his opposite hip. His machete sheath was empty for now, as he was using it to hack through the thick briars that halted his path. Hardly the arsenal of an invader, even with the 2-foot blade in his grasp. Cerberus guards would easily overpower him in the event of a hostile confrontation, but Domi's curiosity had been piqued, and she strove to get in closer. The man paused, wiping his brow with his brawny forearm. He laid his machete on a rock, then reached for his canteen. As soon as he was committed to pulling a swallow of water from the canister, Domi stepped out, crossbow leveled at his chest.
Hold still!
Can I recap my canteen?
No sudden movements. Who are you?
My name's Fargo. I'm on my way to the Cerberus Redoubt to meet with Lakesh and Kane. I'm in a rule there to ask for their assistance.
Anything you can say to them, you can say to me. What do you need?
As I said, I am Austin Fargo. I am an explorer and scientist. Can I move now?
Domi flicked the crossbow's safety back on.
Any sudden movements and the crows will feast on your eyes.
I don't doubt that. You must be Domi. Your name is almost as well known as that of your companions.
Flattery. In my experience, that usually leads a lie.
I'm just attempting diplomacy.
Yeah? Well, you're being diplomatic with the guard dog. Follow me and I'll confirm with the owner of my house that I was right for not chewing your face off.
Don't denigrate yourself, Domi. You're far more than a mere sentry animal.
As they backtracked the 200 yards necessary for Domi to retrieve her satchel of scrounged books, Fargo paid special notice to the fact that her small but sinewy hand never strayed more than an inch from the handle of her fighting knife. From the stories that the Millennial Consortium had cataloged about her, the wiry little albino had the speed and skill to pull that blade and separate a man's head from his torso in the space of a heartbeat. It was an unspoken threat, a warning that Fargo had to keep on his best behavior.
You're on the right path to meet up with my people.
Not the easiest path, but for me, the safest. But make no mistake, my trek has been one of great effort.
You can save the sympathy dirge for someone who actually gives a shit. I caught you sneaking in my back door as a trespasser. Until you get approved by those who I actually do trust, keep your mouth shut.
I understand. You're only protecting your family.
Damn straight.
Grant was scrounging the dead raider's fallen rifles. The powerful Cerberus exile smiled as he picked up a gun that actually looked normal-sized in his massive hands.
What in the hell is that thing?
Grant partially opened the lever action, finding a round seated under the hammer.
A Marlin 4570. Just the thing for when you absolutely positively have to kill a wag in 3 shots or less.
Should have figured these cold hearts would have wheels. I've got a 50.
Kane scooped up the walkie-talkie.
Lombard, cease fire.
Cease fire? Cease fire? You kill my men in cold blood, and when I look for payback, suddenly it's off limits? Fuck you, Kane.
Damn it, Lombard. These people aren't involved in our fight. Stop shooting. You want me or the meds? We can make a deal.
Deal? Where's the cold bastard who executed 10 simple businessmen?
There's no profit in killing these refugees. How much is that ammunition costing you? You want business? Fine. Even killing 3 people per bullet, there's no way your temper tantrum is worth the trigger pull.
There was silence on the other end, and, thankfully, the 50, mounted on one of Lombard's war wags, remained silent as well. Thankfully, there were no cries of agony anywhere, but the Cerberus champions realized that the gunfight only moments earlier had sent the Tartarus inhabitants to cover. Kane glanced at Grant, then nodded. The 2 men knew that Kane was going to have to put himself in the line of fire to prevent an all-out slaughter. Of course, that meant Kane would have to rely on his partner's marksmanship. Grant took his borrowed monster rifle and a belt stuffed with spare ammunition, then disappeared into the maze of houses. Phillips rose from where he had put the finishing touches on securing a prisoner's bandage, wrapping his slashed open face.
We have to check for dead or wounded from that blast.
No. From the general tone, there are no cries of mourning indicating a death, nor calls for help. However, if you stray from this area, the next time Lombard's men do fire that cannon, there's a chance that some of you could be harmed.
But I've got to make sure.
You and your people are too valuable. If Cobaltville is to have any hope of maintaining and improving on what little shred of civilization remains, then it needs smart healers. Stay put until I clear everything.
Kane handed Grant's copperhead to Bridget.
If things go rotten...
I'll escort the medical staff to safety. Watch yourself, okay?
Kane nodded, then jogged to the road.
They're in my sights, Kane.
What have they got?
Thankfully, just old military-style transport trucks. Nothing like the armored Sandcats. I wouldn't be able to punch a hole in one of those. These aren't quite as hard-skinned.
But they can still mount a heavy machine gun.
Only one. The other truck has to make do with riflemen in the back.
How many?
5 split between the 2 vehicles. And there's literally someone riding shotgun with each driver.
We're gonna have to make these bandits very afraid.
The old one magistrate, one riot strategy. I feed you intel and back you up with sniper shots, making you look like the baddest ass on the planet.
That's the one. Where's Lombard now?
Standing next to his machine gunner. He's got an automatic rifle of some sort. He just reached for his radio.
Kane! Come out and play!
I have been. You're the one hiding behind the trucks. Now I'm thinking that it's time for me to quit being so kind and gentle.
Kind and gentle? What the fuck are you talking about?
I'm talking about it's time to stop playing with you and just put you down like the rotten little turd you are. You're just some goon with some fancy guns. You don't even rank in the 10 biggest gangs of bandits I've ever fought.
He's telling his man to shoot, Kane.
Kane dived into a shoulder roll, zooming into the open. Kane and Grant each aimed their weapons. Anyone watching wouldn't see Grant's hidden muzzle flash as the Sin Eater's barrel blazed. The machine gunner grasped his bloody arm as he stumbled away from the 50. The men mounted in the trucks looked at the man who'd been at the controls of their crowd-killing device, then at the lone ex-magistrate getting to his feet out in the open. A tendril of smoke curled from the muzzle of Kane's Sin Eater. Lombard scrubbed at his eyes, grimacing as the injured bandit wound a cord tightly around his arm to tourniquet the injury. Kane walked toward the trucks.
You gentlemen think that because Lombard's with you, you know how to deal with a real magistrate.
From the looks of discomfort among the marauders, he knew that his ploy had worked.
That's bullshit! He's got to have a partner somewhere!
Your partners are all dead. I killed them because Lombard was just too stubborn to realize that he's second class. Now I'm going to appeal to you because I hate wasting good ammunition.
He didn't kill the others by himself.
No, he didn't.
Bridget Baptiste strode into the open, copperhead SMG held against her curvaceous hip.
He had the help of women and doctors, people with no combat training.
So, you have a choice. Ditch your boss and find somewhere else to hunt, or you can all die where you stand.
How do you want them? Dead or alive?
You fuckers!
Lombard lunged at the Browning, but Kane and Grant aimed at the Renegade Mag. Marauders lunged at Lombard, seizing him tightly.
Whatever's easier for you.
God damn you!
Lombard's men hurled him over the cab of the truck. As he clawed to his feet, his angry eyes glared at Kane.
This piece of shit isn't so hot.
Then prove it. You got a sin eater? Show us you're worth following.
Lombard looked around, confused. He eventually rested his eyes on Kane, who stood, arms folded, shaking his head.
Not a good idea.
Lombard glanced toward Bridget.
Don't look at her. She'd just as soon shoot you, but she's not paying for the bullets.
Lombard's eyes flicked to the sin eater on his forearm. One flex and the auto weapon would rocket into his hand. Kane knew, though, that a fast draw with the hydraulic holster was a perishable skill. The movement would be fast, but getting the first shot on target required regular practice. Lombard was a thief who attacked unarmed doctors, not a master gunslinger who constantly honed his skills. In the meantime, Kane had just proved his lethality against younger, hardier men. Lombard reached slowly for the straps on his sin eater, unfastening them. He then dropped to his knees, lacing his fingers behind his head, and Kane turned to glare at the truckloads of remaining bandits.
Go!
The new leader of the robber gang looked at the rest of his men.
They've taken the hint.
Kane walked toward Lombard, pausing only to scoop up the renegade's fallen weapon.
What to do with you?
Grant, that big ape.
Kane took a swift step forward.
Talking about my partner like that is always a bad idea.
You're crazy! What are you gonna do with me?
We'll see if Dr. Phillips needs someone to do grunt work, though nothing too complicated.
You lied when you said there weren't any other X-Mags.
And you were dumb enough not to recognize me. Your bandits were plain and simply outsmarted. We had the communication, we had the knowledge, and now you're just a footnote. 20 marauders with big trucks and big guns taken down by 3 people, and you had disarmed 2 of them.
Lombard grimaced, then noted that Kane was disassembling the surrendered Sin Eater, handing the magazines and the holster to Grant. They looked distracted by the menial task. Lombard reached down to his boot, coming up with a gleaming little pistol in his hand. Bridget kept the copperhead on Lombard, ready to fire again if needed, but he didn't move.
Fool. So busy concentrating on you two, he forgot all about me.
Well, that solves the problem of what to do with the asshole.
A self-resolving problem, most likely. Thanks, Baptiste.
What thanks? I need one of you two to grab that last wheelbarrow full of meds. I'm not busting my back for it.
I love you too, Baptiste.
Mohandas Lakesh Singh had stood just outside the anteroom of the Matrans chamber as Kane, Bridget, and Grant returned from their sojourn to Cobaltville. He waited alongside an impatient Domi who paced like an anxious panther in a cage. Kane looked the 2 people over and knew that whatever was going on, it couldn't be good.
Who showed up? Erica? Sindri?
Why would it be them?
Because Cerberus is still standing, but you're chomping at the bit to let us know some shit's up.
Not Erica or Sindri. Ran into a millennial guy crawling around our back door.
Millennial Consortium? They found us here?
I know that they said they have extensive files on us, but I'm surprised that they know the location of Cerberus.
Why not? Erica knows, so does Sindri and the Overlords, and the Consortium has done business with each of them in the past. In fact, Erica's calling them allies now, after that blowout in China.
And you let him in, Domi?
He wasn't in uniform. No coverall, no button, no Coleco. But he's Consortium. I feel it.
Any corroboration, Lakesh?
Nothing definitive. However, he's hale and healthy, with evidence of having received professional medical treatment. A recent scar on his arm confirms to DeFore that a real doctor stitched it up.
Reba DeFore was the redoubt's chief medical officer. With the influx of staff from the Menidius moon base, the position didn't weigh on her skills as much as it used to. But in the years preceding it, she'd gained a sharp eye toward medical treatment. The stranger's apparent access to such treatment left few options open as to his affiliation. The Millennial Consortium was a budding technocracy, seeking to rebuild America in its own image. Those in charge of the consortium paid lip service to the creation of a utopian society, but their ruthlessness in the pursuit of that goal had brought them into savage conflict with the Cerberus warriors on multiple occasions. The consortium wanted a utopia, and its representatives were willing to kill every person who stood in the path of that objective. Unarmed foes were just as open to murder as the Cerberus personnel.
I also inspected the stranger's gear. His kit includes a leather bullwhip that appears to have bloodstains.
He also couldn't stop buttering all of us up.
They entered a space that adjoined a room where Selah Sinclair and Edwards, members of the Cerberus away teams, stood guard over a bored man. They could observe him through a one-way mirror.
Worse than Lakesh in the beginning, Domi? Friend Kane, beloved Brigid. Not the same at all.
What's his name?
Brigid looked him over. She seemed to be turning over a memory in her mind, not quite believing it.
Austin Fargo.
Fargo sat, dressed in a white shirt, brown pants, and a battered old leather jacket. A wide-brimmed hat sat on the table in front of the man.
And yes, he's dressed almost note for note like an iconic old movie archaeologist.
Has he gotten an earful from Sinclair about that?
Yeah, she only made me sit through those movies 3 times.
I thought you liked him, Grant.
After the 3rd time, with Selah saying all of Dr. Jones's dialogue line for line, it got tiring.
Grant glanced nervously at Brigid.
Not that memorizing things is annoying, mind you.
No offense taken, Grant.
Kane examined the heavy revolver, the machete, and the curled bullwhip. He picked up the whip, examining its light tan leather bandings.
You think you found blood?
DeFore stood in the doorway. The medic, a stocky, buxom woman with bronze skin and ash-blonde hair, had brightened from a dour mood, seeing that Kane and the others were back from their trip to Cobaltville. Despite this, she remained businesslike.
I brought some chemicals to run a test on the whip.
It wouldn't mean much. He could have used it in self-defense, or the blood could have been from an animal. Or the chemical could luminesce in the presence of copper, horseradish, even bleach.
Kane handed the whip to DeFore.
So how many times have you seen someone flay a horseradish root with a bullwhip?
All other things being equal, the simplest solution is the best.
And you say I never learn.
Brigid managed a smile. In the darkened observation deck, DeFore sprayed the whip, and iron traces left behind by blood illuminated the last 4 feet of the wicked lash, glowing brightly. She pulled some tweezers, digging into a seam between 2 strips of leather.
What did you find?
The 2 scientists inspected the scrap trapped between the tweezers' points under a brighter light.
Looks like skin. Dried out and desiccated, but skin. And this was just 1 clump of many that the chemicals exposed.
No fur?
None on closer examination.
And what does Fargo want with us?
He said that he had discovered a cache of military technology in the Kashmir province of the subcontinent. A place between what used to be Pakistan and India. Both nations claimed the land before Skydark, but it was always hotly contested, with terrorists and minor border skirmishes constantly erupting.
So he came to us? We've got all the gear we could ever need here at Cerberus. And if not just here, there's also stuff at Cobaltville. Even the most dedicated army of looters couldn't take all of the equipment stored in a vill.
There's got to be something more, especially if he came to us instead of returning to the Millennial Consortium.
You think he's Consortium now?
Your instincts are rarely wrong.
What do you think?
We've had troubles in India before.
Scorpia Prime and her doomsday cultists. Nagas, right?
We might have solved the problem of Scorpia Prime, but the cult we dealt with may only have been a splinter of a much larger group.
He claims to have encountered a much more dangerous group than just a few snake worshippers.
They were savage enough.
No doubt, Grant. My apologies for the understatement.
He claims to have encountered a new party?
Different from the overlords. He even referenced the genetically augmented soldiers of England. I wanted you to get a look at him, figure out what he actually was before we all talked with him. And if necessary,
loosen his tongue,
shall we?
Kane picked up Fargo's gear, hefting the bullwhip thoughtfully.
We shall.
Selah Sinclair heard Kane's voice over her contact as she sat in the interrogation room with self-proclaimed archaeologist Austin Fargo.
Talk to him. Make it seem like you give a shit what he's all about.
Mm-hmm. So, are you a Freezy? Or did someone show you some vids of the old movies?
Excuse me?
The hat, the jacket, the bullwhip we relieved you of. It's a fairly iconic figure you copied your style from.
It's only your favorite vid in the library here.
Edwards had obviously received the same message from Kane on the contact.
If she wasn't gonna ask, I would've. Where'd you see the original?
A traveling show passed through my town when I was little. They had a wag with its own generator and a widescreen monitor. When I saw him, I knew what I wanted to be. Oh, he was pretty impressive. So we have something in common?
This doesn't mean we'll be holding hands in the shower and taking midnight walks on the beach, so don't get too friendly.
I'm not. I'm just an archaeologist, looking for what's still useful from the past.
With Skydark's destruction and the program of unification, I wouldn't think there would be much left to archaeologue.
There is still pre-Skydark tech not assembled by the unification program or various other parties. When the Barons abandoned their vills, they didn't leave behind many of the keys to their kingdoms.
And you get paid well for finding stockpiles of weapons, vehicles, and electronics.
That's right. But my main goal is to discover what we've lost as a race.
It hadn't been lost on the archaeologist that Sela was a survivor from another time, preserved in suspended animation for centuries, safe from apocalyptic turmoil. The past that Fargo longed to discover lived in this woman. His attention to her lithe, athletic figure also showed more than a little lust had influenced his sudden focus on her. Fargo was a tall, handsome man in his own right. If Lakesh's and Domi's instincts hadn't been tripped by him, Sela wouldn't have minded the attention. The suspicions about Fargo's affiliations, however, prevented any reciprocal appreciation. Domi and Lakesh entered, moving with swiftness and purpose.
My colleagues will be here shortly.
Kane, Grant, and Baptiste?
The same. The map you submitted is of interest. You claim to have encountered a hidden society in what used to be India. One in possession of 20th century military technology.
My expedition was wiped out, and when I made my escape, they pursued me with a helicopter. They have at least three of those, and I also have a feeling they possess genetic re-engineering technology.
What did you say they called themselves again?
They call themselves Naga. No relation to the cultists both your people and mine had encountered farther to the south.
I see.
Three more people entered the room. As large as Edwards was, Grant was even taller, his shoulders even broader. By contrast, Kane was a lean, tightly muscled figure, his body as sleek and efficient as if he were a wolf recast in human form. Kane's eyes held a predatory intensity as he glared at Fargo. The most interesting addition to the population of the interrogation room was Bridget Baptiste. Had her beauty been any less striking, she'd have been swallowed by the imposing ferocity of the two men she accompanied. However, even with her flame-tinted curls pulled back in a severe ponytail and her voluptuous body wrapped in a plain redoubt bodysuit, Bridget was an explosion of beauty. As the trio stared Fargo down, he could sense the flavors of their intellects. Grant emanated cynical distrust. Kane's hard glare tore deep, formulating the most efficient means to kill the archaeologist if necessary. Bridget's observations were cold and clinical, dissecting his every aspect like fibers underneath a microscope. Without saying a word, the three companions had dispelled the chance that tales of their exploits were hyperbole. The trio had an energy to it that was unmistakable, a lethal mix of power and intellect. No wonder Fargo's fellow millennialists had considered the three adventurers the greatest threat to their goals of world superiority.
So, do I meet with your approval?
That bullwhip's seen some hard use. Found bits of human skin in there.
And despite the effort to disguise your allegiance, you possess considerable backing. Where else would you have received such competent medical treatment? Not to mention the quality of your clothing and other equipment.
I got nothing, other than I don't trust this guy.
We were just discussing his claims of a hidden society operating in northwestern India.
So the Millennial Consortium wants us to take a look where their own expedition failed?
Fargo raised an eyebrow in mild astonishment, but Grant waved off the man's reaction.
That's right. I'm not as dumb as you look. Bridget's implications only give me one real option. You're not some mind-controlled toady, so you can't be Erica Van Sloan's errand boy. The snake face survivors are too disorganized and too busy looking for their old toys to bother with hairless apes. All that's left is the consortium.
I've worked for them, but this is not their call. They sent me to get a big fat prize, and the force they supplied me with died. I left empty-handed and alone.
Oh, so the millennialists don't love you anymore. Even if I believed that, I'd still wonder why you don't ask the Dragon Queen for help. She loves ancient artifacts, and she'd provide a good word to get you back into the graces of the consortium.
Well, I'd taken a few of her things during a weekend at the Shan Pyramid. Since Erica joined up with the consortium, She's been looking for an excuse to expel me out into the cold, cruel world. What?
Never thought that I'd sympathize with the wicked bitch of the East. You call yourself an archaeologist, but you're nothing more than a common thief.
Knowledge is power, but it doesn't keep a belly full.
But stealing pays the bills, right? There are a lot of excuses for mercenary activity. Yours is no different. Seeking what we've lost as a race.
I knew it. The waiting game was just to shake my tongue loose. You want the truth about me? Fine. It's not paranoia when you actually do have someone out to get you.
Spoken like someone who has plenty of enemies of his own.
So what about the Naga? They like the other cultists in the South? Snake worshippers?
Worship? Nothing. Scaled skin, hinged fangs, complete with venom sacs capable of spraying blinding poison. They also have hood-like structures, webbing along the sides of their heads that leads down to their shoulders, capable of flexing like a cobra's. I think they're crazy, but insanity isn't strong enough to alter a madman's species by itself. That's why I said they possess the facilities to re-engineer genetics.
It's possible to make enormous changes with the proper technology. I'm living proof of that. Enlil as Sam utilized a swarm of nanites to rebuild my internal organs and restore my relative youth.
That was utilizing Anunnaki technology.
Nanites?
Molecule-scale machines capable of deconstructing and reorganizing matter.
Really tiny robots that can change an old man into a young guy or a normal person into one of your cobra freaks, Fargo.
Thanks.
I know how tough it is listening to Bridget explain things for the first time.
Grant and I jockeyed to get first crack at science books when we arrived. Understanding the basics really helps.
Do you mind? Besides, I thought you didn't trust him.
We don't. And we don't like the murderous little prick either.
But, as you sympathized with Erica, we can sympathize with him.
Continue, please, Fargo.
The Snake Men seem to correlate with mythologies that extend back at least 3 millennia, though the name Naga is localized to the Indian subcontinent.
If you read between the lines, however, there are beings like merpeople, lamia, even gods such as the feathered serpent god Quetzalcoatl. Snake-like humans are not a unique mythology. As well, Lord Strongbow had modified his troops with reptilian aspects, obviously inspired by ancient creatures such as the Formorians.
Durga mentioned Strongbow's people and how they utilized an inefficient form of transformation.
The Tuatha-De-Danann and the Anunnaki entered a truce and combined their technologies. However, one of the regions where they engaged in fiercest conflict was the British Isles. Perhaps the Formorians were these serpentine humans.
I thought that was a leftover memory of when the Snake Faces and the Danann were at war.
Perhaps. There is also a disturbing similarity between the reptilians that Fargo describes and the Nephilim that the Quad V hybrids evolved into.
Domi raised her hand, and both Bridget and Lakesh looked at her.
Bridget, you were helping me do some research on reptilian humanoids after we'd encountered the Hydri mutants in Greece. There was someone,
Ica. David Ica. It popped into my mind as well.
I was around when he posited some of his ideas.
Ica's theories were odd, but they may have had actual scientific basis. He theorized that there were shape-shifting but basically reptilian creatures who secretly ruled the world in the 20th century. They were purported to have had limited shape-shifting abilities, but his position that many world leaders were actually non-humans strained credulity. This, of course, diverges from the traditional mythological texts, where these creatures were not shape-changers. As well, the Naga were not an antagonistic race. They lived in a subterranean realm beneath India. There were also hints that the Naga originated on another continent.
Like Lemuria or Atlantis.
You've been taking notes, Kane. Which brings our friend's comparison to Lord Strongbow's troops full circle.
So, the Naga were not shapeshifters.
Unlikely. Even Ica's contemporary John Rhodes stated that such accusations of Saurian humanoids were unfounded paranoia. The reptoids of Rhodes' description were, like the Indian Naga, subterranean, but with origins in the era of the dinosaurs.
That's a lot to bite off in one session, and I saw the fucking things.
So, are you going to go to India, Kane?
Yes, and I want to come as well. I proved I can handle myself in the field with our last journey to India and the sortie into China.
You're not making me sit it out like you did in China, Lakesh.
Darlingest one, it's too dangerous. Oh.
I've had it with that. I'm perfectly fine with danger. It's my job. Besides, you're too important to Cerberus to risk your life without having someone specifically looking out for you. Kane and the others will be too busy to babysit you, keep their eyes on Fargo, and deal with high-tech snakes at the same time.
I forget. You're not some fragile flower.
And it's not like I can tell you not to go because you speak the language. So I'm coming along.
Fine. Scylla, you and the other away team members can handle things here.
Absolutely, boss. Just don't forget to bring me back something as a souvenir.
What'd you have in mind?
How about your balls if you betray my people?
And our sympathy aside, if the consortium shows up to this party, Fargo, you'll be the first one to catch a bullet.